Thanks, Steve. And thank you all for coming. And thank you to the weather for cooperating. As Steve said, we really were touch and go. I think we're going to have a great panel tonight, panel discussion. And childcare is such a huge issue in our state. And I'm really glad to introduce our guests. As Steve mentioned, we'll start off with a discussion among our guests tonight. And then we'll have plenty of time for questions. And we'll pass the microphone around in a bit. So I'd like to start by introducing, in the middle, Annette Sobosinski. She began her career by earning... Yes? She began her career by earning her master's in social work and working with at-risk children and families affected by violence, poverty, and trauma in Flint. Annette later earned her law degree with the goal of broadening the way she could help young children and families. She's currently the executive director at Child Care Network, which is a nonprofit organization that supports children, families, and child care providers in Southeast Michigan. Please again welcome Annette Sobosinski. To my far left is Jennifer Crutchfield. She's a wife and mother of three boys, ages 9, 16, and 21. She has an associate's degree in applied science in early childhood education from Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland. Jennifer is currently an associate teacher at the University of Michigan North Campus Children's Center, also known as NCCC, and she says she knows all too well about the issues of affordable, quality child care as both a mother and an educator. Please welcome Jennifer Crutchfield. And to my immediate left is Ron French. Ron is a senior writer for Bridge magazine. He joined Bridge in 2011 after having won more than 40 national and state journalism awards during his long tenure at the Detroit News. He has a long track record of uncovering emerging issues and changing public policy debate through his work. In 2006, he foretold the coming crisis in the auto industry in a special report detailing how worker health care costs threatened to bankrupt GM, and he's also written extensively about childcare for Bridge magazine. Please welcome Ron French. Annette, I'd like to start with you, and don't forget to grab your microphone. and I think it would be helpful if you could give us a brief overview of what the Child Care Network does, sure. And then what your group is seeing as some of the top concerns in this part of the state.
Okay. Sure. So Child Care Network, am I the right distance away? Okay.
Can we hear?
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you. So Child Care Network is a regional organization. We cover southeastern Michigan. I describe it as southeastern Michigan counties, not Wayne, Oakland, Macomb. But we cover Genesee, Hillsdale, Lenawee, Livingston, Monroe, Jackson and Washtenaw. So what we do is we are a program that provides support for children, families, and child care providers. So we do that through two main programs, one of which is the Great Start to Quality Southeast Resource Center. We are one of 10 resource centers in the state of Michigan. They're regional resource centers. And what we do with the resource center work is we support families with help finding child care that meets their needs, that best meets their needs. And then we support child care providers with improving the quality of care that they provide to young children. So we do that through training. We have lending library resources. We do on-site consultation with child care providers in those seven counties that we serve. So that's one of our programs. And then the other main program that we have is our Family Support Program, which is a child care tuition scholarship program. And it helps families afford the high cost of high quality child care. So that we offer scholarships to families up to 250% of the federal poverty level. So
what are some of the top concerns or issues that you see in the region that you're covering?
Well, so many issues, right? So for families, it's trying to find affordable child care that meets their family's needs, that are offered at the hours that the family needs them, in a location where the family needs them, that provides the services that the family needs. And then for providers, the challenges of, you know, operating with not a whole lot of income and providing high quality care to children and families. So doing that through resources that they may have available to them, but the tuition that the families provide is what helps them to run. So licensing is an issue with childcare providers, getting the training requirements met that they need, getting all the background checks that they need to be able to run their programs. These are kind of ongoing issues that providers have.
Ron, you wrote a series of articles about childcare for Bridge Magazine, and one of the most striking things that you found came up when you compared the cost of childcare with the cost of another form of education in Ann Arbor. Can you tell us a little bit about how childcare tuition stacks up against going to U of M?
Yeah, unfortunately I can, because I just had two daughters graduate from U of M. Anyway, yeah, for a middle class family that earns between, say, $48,000 and $75,000 a year in Michigan, because it actually is cheaper to go to U of M, to send a kid to U of M for 4 years, than to be in 4 years of childcare, high-quality childcare. It's stunning, and it says a lot about some of the issues that families like you guys are facing, because the huge, you want to get your children in as high quality care as possible, so you're willing to put that money away for that. At the same time you're doing that, then you cannot save money for college to send your kid to U of M. And so it's a cycle that really needs to be broken in some way.
Jennifer, before we get into your experiences working today in childcare and early ed, I'd like to ask you to tell us the story about your experience when you started having kids and how you ended up deciding that you needed to pursue childcare as a career.
Okay, certainly. Well, I have two boys who have ADHD, and one has ADHD and ODD, which is oppositional defiant disorder, meaning that if you say the sky is blue, he will argue that the sky is purple all day long, and that's the end of it. The other one has ADHD with anxiety issues. So with that first child, at two, I knew something was different about him. At three, they kept telling me, you know, you need to get something. They kept saying that he's a boy, he'll grow out of it, he'll grow out of it, he'll grow out of it. So he didn't grow out of it. And he constantly got kicked out of childcare. And that's because at that time in 1998, 99, 2000, the quality of care, the educators, well, you couldn't really call them educator. You didn't really need to have a background in early childhood education to, you know, help those children. And so what really got me into it is when my second son came along. His program, initially as an infant, it was great. But when he became... That's the smoker. When he was a preschooler, I put him in this, he was in the same program, but I walked in and he was watching TV. And it's like, I know he could be doing something else. And so I ended up going to school, getting my associate's degree. And then in 2010, I had my other son. And then we got shipped up and moved out to Michigan. And so, did you want to continue with that story?
Sure, sure. And then you decided to sort of be part of the change, I guess, right? In a way, I mean, that you wanted to, you saw what you didn't like in the field.
Yes, I saw what I didn't like and decided to do something about it and learn more information about it, so I can help children. And like I tell everyone when I interview with my new position, that I like the children with challenging behaviors, because they are they're not valued as much, I believe, and it's a hard time for educators to understand those children.
Annette, Jennifer's son, as she just said, her oldest son is 21, but some of the themes that she talks about are things that are still going on two decades later. What are some of the biggest changes you've seen in that period? I mean, are we seeing a shift in terms of the quality of care and what's available?
Yeah, so, well, we are seeing a shift in the quality of care. There's been a huge effort over the last 5 years in Michigan to really look at quality and improve that through the state's quality rating and improvement system. And so there's been a lot of effort towards that at the state to get providers into a system where they they assess their own level of quality and then work to improve that quality. So so that's been a huge shift in the state of Michigan in the last 5 years, and it continues to grow ongoing all the time. And then as it relates to availability of childcare, the same thing that's been happening in Michigan during that same time period is a decrease in the number of licensed programs. So I don't remember the exact numbers. I just was in Genesee County today and was focused on their numbers, and they've had a 31% decrease in the number of licensed childcare providers in the last 7 years.
Do you know why that is?
So there are so many reasons why that is. It's kind of a complicated question, but many times providers, you know, the licensing requirements can be a challenge for providers to continue to meet and make sure they, you know, are in line with licensing requirements. It's expensive. Many providers go into this field because they have a passion and a love for children, but not necessarily because they have all that much experience or knowledge about what it takes to run a business. And so the challenges of running a business can be overwhelming, right? So I mean, those are just a few of the reasons why there's been a decrease.
Ron, in a story published in January, you wrote about four different people representing different aspects of the child care issue. And one of them was a director of a child care facility in Lansing. So this facility has a capacity of 80 children, and it has a 13-month waiting list. I'm not a doctor, but I think that's longer than it takes to make an infant, never mind to get one into the school. So you talked to parents who also waited longer than they might have otherwise to have their second child so that they could have just one child care payment. I just wonder what else stood out to you about the stories that you heard while you're doing the reporting for that story.
In general, what stood out is how much child care shapes people's lives today. As you said, people waiting to have a second child because they can't afford childcare for two. The concept of where they might live because they can't afford quality childcare, so they need to live close to a relative sometimes. And from the other end, just the waiting to get into a high quality. I can't emphasize enough what you were saying about coming in and seeing your son watching television. I cover education from birth to through college, and so I look at data a lot. Okay, too much. But one thing that you will notice is that the academic gap that exists in kindergarten is often the same gap that exists when they're seniors in high school. That gap exists before they get to kindergarten. And so that's why high quality care is so freaking important. You know, and so that talks about you have to talk about cost. You also have to talk about training that I'm sure you've had that some people do not have. And I guess what stands out to me is just it is such a huge issue that I think doesn't get nearly as much political attention as it should.
Jennifer, I'd like to turn to your professional work, and could you tell us a little bit about the center where you work and sort of how that's structured? So just kind of describe that setting so we get a sense of it.
Okay, so I work at the University of Michigan North Campus Children's Center, long name, and it's Reggio inspired, and so it's you're basically letting the children be free, and we provide thought-provoking activities that's based on the child's interest, what we overheard them say and do, and so we put things in their environment that will spark that interest even more and see where it goes.
And when at that center, most of the children have a tie to U of M in terms of faculty or staff of the university. Is that right?
Yes.
So there you have a setting there where people are either in education or around education and invested in it. Can you describe some of the conversations you have with the parents and the families about childcare in general? I mean, what do you hear when you talk about the system with the clients at your center?
So I'm different. I'm a floater. So I don't I support the other teachers. So I don't have that much interaction with the parents.
Maybe a better question is, what do you hear from your colleagues? I mean, about what, how that compares, or how that sort of system, where you're in a larger institution, where you're surrounded by a fairly affluent area, a fairly educated area, but how does that compare to other places where you've worked and in other settings that you've been in?
So, based on what I've seen and heard, some of the parents really aren't, I don't really want to say this. they're really not really into it, is what I want to say.
They're not
because
into it.
I have the money, so it really doesn't matter to me. And I hate to say that.
And is that different when you've worked at places that have more of the other end of the spectrum? Is that?
So previously I was in the same, it was like kind of like the same income bracket. So it's like, but this, the one previous was private and it was academic based. So in that environment, I saw more, I want my child to be a physician at 3 years old. And it was Montessori and we had 4-year-olds doing 4-digit multiplication problems. I kid you not. And that's because they were using the Montessori tools to do those multiplication problems. I was like, oh, that's very interesting. The one previous, it was more of, it's a placeholder for me. I just need to find care for my child while I work, and I really can't afford it. So that was a different tax bracket. Oh, yeah, income bracket. So,
Annette, I want to throw out a couple of statistics. In 1968, just 27% of married mothers were in the workforce. That number jumped to 65% by 1992, and it's hovered right around there. It's a little bit lower today than it was. And for the same years, 1968, it was 45% of single mothers. Now we're at about 75%. And during that time, fathers in the workforce is now about 95%. That's down a little bit, but it's hovered right up near 100%. So we're, in the course of 30 years, that's a huge shift from the 60s to the 90s.
Right.
And then we're about 20 years into that being the new norm. Mm-hmm. I just wonder your thoughts about this sort of a seismic shift in a relatively short amount of time based on the long history of how we dealt with caring for children and what the change, where we're at in terms of the cultural change that's happened in this last generation, two generations, and how that's affecting the child care that you see day to day in your work.
Well, obviously the need is much higher for child care for children to be cared for in a safe setting. So that's the main thing that comes to my mind. I think and the thing is, even with the increase in single parents, childcare is often unaffordable for parents, when both parents are working, right? Those costs that Ron was talking about compared to U of M. So I think with that shift in the employment, I think it only goes to show why, again, we should be investing in this population of children, all children really, but especially that birth to five population. Because those 1,000 days of the first 1,000 days of life are the most critical in terms of brain development and all of that. So making sure that there are safe and affordable and high quality settings for those children is just critical to ensure that the success of those children, but then also overall society, right? The communities that those kids live in are impacted by their trajectory in life. So that just demonstrates how important it is for us to invest in those children.
I just want to get a quick show of hands. I've done some casual polling leading up to this. I'm just going to list a few issues, and I'd just like to have a hand raise if this is the top issue for you with child care. How many people are concerned about availability, like having a problem finding the child care that they wanted? We've got one over here and one out there, a couple. Oh, no. I won't tell. I won't be able to keep track. How about quality in terms of being able to find the quality you want? So a lot more hands. And how about cost? And just about the same or more. And I asked one of our thoughtful colleagues, a thoughtful editor at the station today who always has ideas for interviews and things. And I said, do you have a question that you'd like to ask the panel tonight? And she just looked at me and said, cost. What's the deal with the cost? I mean, it comes back to that so often. Ron, in 2017, Michigan had the lowest income cutoff in the U.S. for families to get child care subsidies. If they made more than $25,000, roughly $100, they became ineligible for subsidies to help. That number went up last year, but the state is still in the bottom five, as you've reported. And it's not just a case of states that have the most resources. North Dakota, Vermont, Maine, Alaska, all in the top 11 or so for having much higher cutoffs. What was your findings, or what were your findings about what Michigan's doing and how it sort of got into that position in that particular ranking?
Gosh, it must be the one area where we rank toward the bottom, huh? How are our roads?
Comment.
Yeah, no. Now, it's again one of those areas where policy has not kept up with the changes in society, particularly in Michigan. The cutoff for child care assistance is just so incredibly low. It's been raised. It went from 125% of the federal poverty line to 130. Now it's 140, which is still crazy low. There is a separate program for 4-year-olds that the income cutoff is quite a bit higher, but then the other half of that equation is that even if you do qualify, the amount of money, and I'm sure you two are very familiar with this, that the amount of money that providers get for care from the state is so incredibly low that there's not a lot of incentive for providers to accept those students. So I know Governor Whitmer now has proposed some changes, wants to increase it, but then again, she didn't include it in this year's budget because she could only do so much, and she decided to put all her eggs in the basket of trying to increase college scholarship money. But the point is, we are way behind the other states. And if you want to look at it from a macro point of view, it affects the economy. It affects our ability to draw workers to the state.
Annette, I'd like to ask you about sort of the model of the businesses that get involved. I mean, there is money to be made, or else child care centers wouldn't be opening. But you and I were also talking about how there can be some counterintuitive things as we increase things like Head Start or increased pre-K programs, which seem like a gain, it can hurt the overall pool of what's available. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure, yeah. So when there is, in certain areas, when there's an increase of publicly funded preschool programs like Head Start or the Great Start Readiness Program for 4-year-olds, free state preschool for 4-year-olds, it can have an impact on the private child care providers in the area, unless there's some really good collaboration and partnership between the entity who has the publicly funded preschool and the private child care provider community. And so the way that impacts it is for the private child care providers, if they're caring for children who are birth to age 5, the 4 and the 5-year-old, so from a running a program, I'm trying to think of how to explain this, running a program perspective, infants and toddlers are much more expensive to run the program for because it requires a much higher staff-to-child ratio for the younger children. So if you're running a program that's birth to 5 years old and you suddenly lose all of your 4- and 5-year-olds because they're now going to GSRP programs or Head Start programs, then you're only having to run your program based on birth to 3-year-olds, which is a much more expensive from a business perspective, from a business standpoint.
Well, imagine if your kids just kept staying under 3. There would be no hope, right?
Right.
Jennifer, from your perspective as working in the industry, how hard is it for you and your colleagues to be on the other end of that financial equation without getting into the specifics of your financial situation, but with the fact that money does not trickle down? It's no secret that the people who are working with our kids and taking care of our most precious possessions mm-hmm. are not often compensated well, and or in many places are not. I mean, what has been your experience, and what's your view of the difficulties for the people who are in your field?
Of course, the pay, the rate of pay. You don't get paid that much, but then you want quality. So for someone to, because like now I'm paying on a $26,000 loan for an associate's degree. So now if you start having these standards and you want lead teachers to have a bachelor's degree, then that means I have to go to school and take on debt that I'm not going to be able to pay for.
And I'm sure this is true. It's certainly been my experience with my own kids. I have two kids that are 6 and 8, two daughters, that the most of the people are in it for their passion for it, right? I mean, are most of your colleagues, I would imagine, care deeply about it. That's what we seem to see and hear in most places. Is that true where in the various places you've worked?
Yes, the passion and love for children, and to see them grow and develop by the activities you have provided or set up for them. That's why we go into it. But then when you start making stipulations and standards, it becomes hard because now we have to check a box. And now it's not going to be developmentally appropriate activities for these children, because in order, if you go that route with state funding and have to check this box, then my activities, I have to restructure my activities to check the box and make sure I'm meeting standards, and then I'm losing that passion because I'm not basing it on that child, that individual child. I'm basing it on what the state wants me to do.
Jump in.
Yeah.
Mine be short.
Yeah, I just think of it this way. You know, what jobs are out there that you need an associate's degree to do that pay less than what you do? And what jobs out there that take an associate's degree are more important to society than what you do? You know, it's just incredible the way we do not support the people who make the biggest difference in our kids' lives sometimes.
Yeah, and I just wanted to comment on that. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. Comment on that, too, that, you know, yes, the standards can be challenging. Of course, we want there to be standards. We want there to be, you know, requirements for high quality. But we need to figure out a way to make sure that we have that, but are also able to compensate the employment force at a rate that makes more sense for what they're doing, that the important work that they're doing.
Is there, Annette, a sort of a market economy factor in there that where... when the economy's riding high, centers can charge more, and then is it just not trickling down, or is it, how does that factor in? And then if you see consolidation, like you were talking about earlier a little bit, where there are fewer licensed operations, does that also drive price up at the remaining licensed operations?
I don't know the answer to that question. I really don't know. I don't think so, because I think there's a limit at which families are able to afford the care, and so providers aren't really able to raise their prices to any higher, even with the market changing, because they won't have kids, right? So I don't think so, but I don't actually know the answer.
Ron, I'm not sure if you've heard, but we're at a politically contentious point in our country's history. You may have heard mention of that in the news. You wrote a bit about how some of these issues have crossed the political aisle, and you wrote about a group of right-leaning or Republican-backing CEOs who are pushing for change in this area. Could you tell us a little bit about what they're looking for and where that sort of lands in Lansing?
Sure. There's a lot of good and bad you can say about term limits, but one thing it does is often the older dudes who are in there leave and younger people come in as legislators. And when you have a legislator who's in their late 20s to early 40s, they almost all have children that are either in child care or recently out of child care. And so they are very familiar with this. And this is something that hits everybody. It's not as in Lansing. You'll find some groups that are sort of anti higher education. Okay, say, well, that's not for everybody. You know, I did fine without it. Whatever, but everyone has to pay for childcare. It hits everyone, and so yeah, there's a growing consensus in Lansing that this is an issue that has to be addressed. But frankly, until they fix the roads, I don't think they're going to spend a lot of money on this yet.
Annette, how does the factor of sort of unlicensed childcare play in? I mean, you have sort of natural settings where you've got a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle or a family caregiver, and then you have unlicensed settings that are not the best or provide their own set of dangers. But tracking that has to be very difficult, and then getting people to be able to look past that when they can't afford the next level is also difficult. What do you see in the field in your work?
So when I talk about unlicensed providers, we have to like kind of separate them into different groups. So there's like one is called license exempt providers, which are really their family, friend, and neighbors that parents use, who go through a process with the state of Michigan where they attend an orientation, they learn about child development. They become CPR and first aid certified, and then they're eligible to receive subsidy payments for caring for a family, friend, or neighbor. So that's one group, that one population. You see it most often in larger cities, in urban settings, where there's a high number of license-exempt providers. But then there's also family, friend, and I just call them general family, friend, and neighbor care providers, who are the same thing, essentially, but they haven't gone through the process to become license-exempt, either because the family doesn't qualify for the child care subsidy or the family doesn't even know that that's an option to get child care subsidy and use it with a family, friend, and neighbor care provider. So we have no way to estimate the number of you know, just informal family, friend, and neighbor providers. But it is where a large number of our children are in those settings. And so when some states do a really good job of supporting that population, that both, you know, informal and formal license exempt family, friend, and neighbor providers, and really, you know, make sure that no matter where the children are, try to work hard at increasing quality, because we know first of all, we know there's not enough spots for children in licensed care programs. And second of all, you know, not all families are comfortable with licensed care. There are many families who would much prefer to choose somebody that they know are familiar with, you know. And so how do we support the children in all settings to make sure that all kids have a high quality experience?
I'd like to hear about some things that are working well. And Jennifer, I wonder just what you've seen in your time in your profession. What gets you excited? What methods or changes that you've seen that you think are working and are serving the children that you work with well?
I think, sorry.
I like my new setting. I have to say that. Michelle, just allowing children to be children and explore, that's been working, not doing the themes. You got thematic, we do A, B, C all week long. Recently, I'm in a classroom where I see kids, what do you see here? What are these?
Cups.
Cups. Are they cups? What can they be?
Oh, right. They could be pyramids or towers or...
Exactly. And that lead teacher, you know, took something as simple as blocks and she put cups in their environment. And they have different color cups and they're stacking the cups. Then we added tea lights and we turned off the lights. That's the change that we need to see when we talk about quality education in early childhood, and that's letting children be children and not doing ABC work.
What do you think's working in that? Oh, no, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I wanted to tag on to what you said.
Yeah.
So that's something that I think is really important and that often gets lost in the conversation about childcare. And even with parents sometimes, they see their children in a setting where there is that free play going on, children are given the opportunity to explore. That's critical. Teachers who guide children to do all of that work is critical to brain development. And so there sometimes are times when parents think, no, my child is in preschool. They should be doing worksheets and preparing for kindergarten and doing that ABC work and that 1-2-3 work, but really that's not what kids should be doing. That's not what's normal for kids to do at that developmental level, and it's important to really understand that and help people understand that that's critical.
Ron, from your reporting, what did you see or hear about that people were satisfied with, or what was working well? Oh, no, this is a bad sign. Reporters, we're always the most cynical.
Yeah, absolutely. What gives me the most optimism, I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
Okay, what gives me the most optimism is that business leaders in Michigan are rallying around the idea that we have to fix this problem in some way. They're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts, let's be honest. It's because it's affecting their workers. They're either having workers who can't show up to work every day, or they're losing workers because the child care costs more than they're making in a paycheck. So it's an issue that business leaders, I can tell you, business leaders are having meetings with government leaders trying to figure out how to address this issue. They haven't figured it out yet, but that's a very positive step, because business leaders make donations, and so politicians listen to people who give donations. It'll get better. It won't get resolved, but it will get better soon, I think.
So I want to go back in and answer the question you actually asked me instead of just tagging on what Jennifer said. So there's several things that I think are working well in Michigan. I think that the fact that we actually do have reimbursement for childcare subsidies, even though it's as low as it is, it's good that exists for parents to help them afford childcare. I think it's great that we've really focused hard on improving quality of childcare settings for children. So. And I think, Ron, you were talking earlier about in Michigan, there's more of a focus and a discussion. Everybody needs childcare. That's true not only in Michigan, but on a national level too. And that's something that's really good, that there's increasing focus on this as an issue, and that people are paying more attention. And I think that the optimism will result in positive changes for children and for families.
So I'd like to open it up to audience questions. So if you have a question, you can raise your hand or a comment, and Chrissy will bring the microphone around to you. And I'd just like to note a couple things. This is the kind of evening where we're likely to get stories. We'd love to hear your story. If you can try to consolidate it and maybe end with a question that you can ask. And if you'd like to hear from a particular panelist, it can be helpful if you note that too. But if you have a question, feel free to stick up your hand at any point. We'll try to get to as many as we can tonight. And it looks like we have a couple to start in the back here. So. And please tell us where you're from and tell us your baby's name.
Yeah, hi.
You weren't able to get childcare tonight.
Precisely. I'm Amber. I'm from Farmington, and this is Hannah and Dave. We are really happy with our childcare center, but it is extremely expensive, as we all have been talking about tonight. I also know that our providers in our classroom, they make very little, and I also know that our childcare center is barely able to rise above out of the red. And so it just all of the, I know it's, there's no quick answer to this, but are there other states that do this differently? Is there a way that the system could be more beneficial for all three parties, people who are running the centers, the people who are providing this care, and also for parents who are just trying to afford care? Are there states that do this better than us, and what are they doing?
You've got your microphone up, Annette. Jump in there.
I don't have an answer, but I have thoughts. So I can't necessarily speak to what other states do. I'm not that familiar with what other states do. I can say that other countries do this better and differently than what we do. I can say that this morning I did a presentation on childcare in Michigan, ironically, and as I was pulling up images to put into the presentation that I was doing, I kept seeing images of the United Kingdom and many other countries, and ads for 30 hours that all parents can have access to 30 hours a week of free childcare. Like, what an amazing thing that would be in our country if we invested in kids like that. And that would support the providers, the children, and the parents all. So I'm sorry it's not exactly an answer, because I don't know specifically about other states, but I do have thoughts about that and ideas.
Ron?
We have to start looking at it as infrastructure. It is infrastructure for society. American in general has not considered it that way. But I think that we're going to have to at some point consider it as something just as important as filling the potholes.
Fix the damn child care? Is that the idea?
Okay, so we have piggyback onto that. Have there been state-level studies on what the ROI is of subsidizing childcare? Obviously, as birth rates decline because of the cost and the expense, we're a declining population state, and that's not a sustainable future for us.
So there have been ROI studies on, so I don't know specifically on what you're asking, but there have been return on investment studies in investing in children overall, and that investing in early childhood education for children, for every dollar you invest, brings back at least, conservative estimates are at least a $7 rate of return. So there's a whole, Heckman, I can't think of his first name, but he's an economist, and he studies this issue and provides lots of information on this that is great to use when talking with legislators about why it's important to invest in early childhood.
Okay, we've got another question.
Hi, my name is Kristen Schrader. I'm with Girl Scout Tutter, Michigan, so we work with kids all the time. And my daughter's name is Fern. She's not here tonight, but she's 11. She's a good girl. She's a good Girl Scout, too. You'll be shocked to hear. I'm wondering what you think about partnering with private industry on this. I do feel like this should be in this infrastructure, but I don't trust the government to stay consistent on funding. You know, that things swing back and forth. Is there a way that we can, I hate to say throw it back on private industry, but partner with them so they're picking up a bigger part of it?
If there was some sort of a cookie sale model, for example.
I don't know. I mean, people say they're...
My daughters are big sellers, I saw.
So, I'm sorry, I feel like I'm talking too much. But no. There have been discussions. I mean, like what we were talking about, Ron was talking about the business leaders in the state who are starting to think about this and be invested in a different way because they want to have a reliable workforce. So, yes, I think that there is room for discussion around how do we encourage private businesses to either subsidize the care for their workers. You know, I've spoken with President CEO who've considered opening their own childcare facility, but then, you know, there was challenges inherent in that they did not anticipate or, you know, expect. So, yes, I definitely think there's room in this field for that to take place on a broader basis.
We've got another question right there.
Yeah. My name is Michelle Smith. I'm an early Head Start teacher for Starfish in Inkster. I wanted to piggyback off the investment conversation we were just having. You said one for every $1 we spend in the classroom, we save $7. That is a conservative estimate. And for Head Start, it's even a larger sum. Talk about your Blue Light Kmart special. Right. You know, it doesn't get any better. And I have seen, I've been in the field a lot of years, and I have seen a bit of a paradigm shift that we're at least paying lip service to that investment. But I think we have a long way to go. We've got a long way to go.
Jennifer, do you feel like in the time that you've been working in the field, do you feel like there's more of an appreciation for what you do than when you started?
Again, I'm going to go to the tax bracket thing. It depends on the clients you are serving. When I was in my first center and we had a diverse population where it was mixed and you had low income, they appreciated it because they saw the growth and development of their children because we had some quality teachers there. But when you go into a higher tax bracket, sometimes they really don't care if this is just a child care center. Now, when you talk about, I don't want to mention the name, but it's a private Montessori school, they were more invested in the academics. So I don't care that my child is stacking cups. I need to see why is he stacking cups.
All right, let's take another question.
Oh, yeah. Hello, Colin McLeod. My daughter is Moira Jade McLeod. She's 6 months old, and she's just about the cutest thing in the world. So, Ron, earlier you had mentioned that this issue doesn't get the political attention that it deserves, and you had sort of discussed a little bit about how, as the representatives are getting younger. Some of this is starting to change slowly, but I was interested. I was hoping that like we could sort of go down the line and everybody mention, you know, a short bulleted list of what you think it would take to get the political attention around this issue that, that we really need.
I think it requires continued advocacy, continued discussion, continued getting in front of the face of the people who can make a difference, right? So making sure that they hear and they understand all of the different aspects, whatever makes sense for that particular person. So I'll give you a personal example. I'm a member of a professional organization, and one of the things that we do is advocacy work. And my experience, you know, speaking to the change in the legislature, my experience with a public policy forum that I attended a year ago with my legislator at the time, who I won't give names, but he was an older white male who essentially said to me, no, we need to go back to a time when mom stayed at home, met their kids on the bus, families, it was two-parent families always, moms were always the caretaker, that's what we need to return to. And that was his whole attitude. So with that, how are you ever going to have an impact on somebody who has that mindset? Whereas this year when I went, it was a much different, they were much more receptive to learning more about early childhood and what impact we could have that would, you know, and so it doesn't matter Republican or Democrat or whatever, just trying to make sure that you can tell the story in a way that is meaningful to that person who is making policy decisions around early childhood.
Ron?
The more you can tie it to the economy, the better off you are with politicians. Okay, they don't care if you're having to work harder for childcare, but they will care if the factory owner down the street can't get enough workers. So tying it to the economy that it's holding people back, that sort of thing is something that resonates in Lansing, and it gets you to the same point. I mean, it may not be the reason you think that we should be addressing it, but it's most things in Lansing are tied to money, and so the more you can tie this issue to money, the better off you are.
I wonder too if there's a factor of the rolling nature of the interested parties. I mean, of a consistency of voice. Like parents keep graduating out of the issue, right? I mean, after if you have one child, you are start to become done with that issue at five or six or seven or less and less. Anyway, I just wonder if that factors in. Let's take another question.
Okay. You deferred to me? How sweet of you. Hi, I'm Barb Fliss, Parent Action for Healthy Kids, and I think Ron is going to become my new best friend because I like your comments. I was pleased about the comments about businesses finally getting their attention, and I think the issue for that is much bigger than just recognizing daycare, but flexible hours for parents and so forth. I mean, it's a much bigger issue than that. And then I like the term infrastructure because in my mind, infrastructure to me means that I would like our state to be a state that starts valuing families. That gentleman that you talked about, that was the era of family values, family values. They've gone down the toilet. We're family. No, we, you know what? We've never valued families. And families come in all shapes and sizes and economic status and all colors. And some of them know things and some of them don't know what they don't know. But what they all do is they all care about their families. And our families are so stressed out right now that they can't even... It's wonderful that some families can make it here. And then we pick on families because they don't show up at PTA meetings or they don't show up here when they're racing home to pick their kids up so they don't get charged extra at daycare. They can't go to events, but yet we continue to judge them and blame them. And that has got to stop.
Let's take the woman who deferred to the woman in front of her.
Hi, I'm Tammy Arikelian. I'm an early childhood professional. I'm also a parent of a 6, 8, and 10-year-old boy. Relating back to the fact that families are stressed, when we look at this need for childcare and we look at the specific need for infants and toddlers is greater, And if we look at some research, it shows that that attachment that happens during those first 2 years is so important. And we look at countries like Denmark that have maternal leave for a year and paternal leave for a year so that the first 2 years the child, the family has the resources to be able to have that bond with the child. Where is that paternal, maternal leave aspect in this conversation to address the need for high-quality childcare? And if you aren't seeing it, what do you recommend be a step to bring that into the conversation?
I mean, I could just say that I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing it. So I think that's an excellent point. I think that should be something that is discussed, but it's not something that I'm seeing discussed at all.
You can't even get minimum wage raised up to a living wage around here. I that sounds ideal. I think we're a long way off from that. I don't even know how to address that issue among politicians to make any headway.
So personally, I've seen it. It's not a year or 2 years, but with Ford, the father is allowed also 3 months off. So that's a step. It's a step. Yeah. Versus, you know, and the mother they could get 3 months off on maternity leave. Again, that's a step versus the 6 weeks. Yeah, because that puts a lot of pressure on a mother just have a baby.
And I think U of M also just made a change to their policies too. So you can see pockets of it with different individual organizations that value this, but on an overall broader scheme in the discussion, it's just not something that I'm hearing a lot of.
Hi.
Good, you're holding that. Thank you. I'm going to give you a 10-second shout-out and appreciation. The Child Care Network helped me with my daughter. She's not 21, so 19 years ago, and I would not have been able to continue in my program of study had that they not provided me with that subsidy. So thank you. And in case you all didn't know, they are listed with the United Way, so feel free to make a donation to them through the United Way.
Thank you.
They didn't pay me for that. My name is Caroline Sanders, and I just wanted to make a comment about a solution that myself and my university have looked at. We recently have partnered with the YMCA of Ann Arbor to create a child care collaborative center. And we were running into difficulties finding people that would be staffers, that would be teachers, right? There is a low salary issue. It is a love. And so Eastern decided that we would try and do a collaborative where we reached out to Washtenaw Community College and said, look, if we are able to finance participants interested in doing the child development certification, then let's do that. So we're looking to roll that out starting in the fall, also with Michigan Works in our area that will pay for their customers. It's about a $1,500 program, another $450 to take the certification exam. But that was our response to how do we help with this shortage of teachers in, you know, child care centers that won't just benefit the YMCA, but other centers in Washtenaw County, and be able to allow sort of stackable credentials for people that love children, need a job, and may even be able to have their child with them at that center as they're working and be able to possibly continue with an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. And I just wanted to, Jennifer,
yeah.
The issue that I found with my own child was, like you said, when you get to a certain socioeconomic level, you don't even take the time to say good morning to your teacher. You're paying $6 an hour for somebody to keep your child, 50 to 60 hours a week, and you can't even have the courtesy to just ask them how they're doing or to take enough time to know what's their situation and just inquire about it. It makes a difference to them, especially when you're not paying them, you know, what it's worth. How much is your child worth?
Can I tag
yes,
into that?
Yes, thank you for your comments.
Yes, thank you so much for your comments. both for the first one that was great, but also I can't believe that I can't believe we've had this whole conversation and I neglected to mention that issue right there. The issue that you're talking about programs, challenges of programs for finding and retaining staff who are qualified, credentialed, good at what they do, you know, all of those things. That is a huge challenge in this field overall. And so thank you for bringing that to the group's attention.
I just want to piggyback on that. What I like about my new place, thank you, is they provide that work-life balance because it is challenging being in the field. When I was there before, I had that issue of I love this job, but I also have a family, and I feel guilty if I have to take a day off because one of my children are sick. So what I like at my current position, my current job, University of Michigan North Campus Children's Center, that they provide that work-life balance so I can still be a mom.
All right. We'll get another question.
My name is Joan Firestone. I've been involved in all facets of early childhood for many years. I have two grandkids now who are in child care. And I want to get back to what you were talking about with the staff, because that, to me, is the most critical issue, that if you don't have good staff, you can't possibly be doing what you're doing for kids. And you had asked about, is this better economy helping at all with charging parents more? Really, the better economy is making things much harder for child care centers, because as the entry-level wages are going up at Target and at Burger King, they can't keep the staffs because they are paying less, even though people have two-year credentials often. We are seeing nationally, I've been on the board of the National Association for the Education of Young Children. Centers are closing rooms. Centers are closing whole programs because they can't find consistent staff. My kids in California are paying almost $30,000 a year for child care for two kids, and they have not had consistent staff for either of their kids all year. And they are at a company-sponsored child care center. The company mandates both the quality and the cost. And they're saying that they have to have it at an affordable cost so the center can't charge more. But it's also got to find high-quality teachers. It sometimes puts people in an impossible position. This is the only country that's an industrialized nation that does not have a national policy about family leave and child care. It has been estimated that to get one that was good would cost taxpayers about $50 billion a year for the costs to pay reasonable wages and to have families pay maybe on a sliding scale what they could. There's nobody willing to talk about putting that kind of money in the care. And I think until the situation implodes, until staff refuse to work for what they're paid, and parents can't find care and businesses can't operate, nothing is going to happen.
And if you shift to those jobs at Target or the bigger companies, you might also be able to get a better benefits package or get involved with what those the massive corporations are able to offer that a center isn't. Should we take another question? Chrissy's in the back now.
Hi, my name is Perry. I've got two children, Lewis, who's 3, and Viola, who's 10 months. We had a really great daycare. We really loved. They were kind of expensive, but that's part of this. But just before Viola was born, they had to move away because of basically all kinds of things with where their location was at, because they were renting it from Ann Arbor School District. And like, it just kind of ties into this whole thing of stability, because of the fact that on top of the thing with staffing themselves, but if the locations themselves can't even save in the same spot, like, yes, they found a new location, the other side of Ann Arbor, which was almost a half an hour drive longer than what it was already to us. it just wasn't tenable for us to keep going to that same school. And they lost, not only did they lose a lot of students, they lost a lot of staff as well because of that move. And it just makes it so much more difficult for the entire community that was relying on that one institution to help their children along.
Ron, could I ask you to sort of tap back into the story where you we looked at the four people involved? I mean, where were some of those real crunch points for the different aspects of that as you looked at the different aspects of the industry of childcare and the issues around it?
Crunch points, you mean where?
Like where the most friction is, or the difficulties for turnover, I mean, where the biggest sort of roadblocks were for kind of success or growth?
Sure. As you've heard already, you know, families can't pay much more, so they can't increase the cost enough to give raises to the level that Jennifer deserves. And the state isn't investing enough to compensate that in some way. So as far as crunch points, it really just comes down to the model that exists. And it's, Michigan's not alone, right? It's every state is struggling with this. You know, the families can't afford it, and my goodness, most childcare workers can't afford to send their own kids to high quality childcare. So it really is. There's really, to me, there's only one crunch point, and that is we have to reach a crisis point where there is a change in thinking, like we're starting to see with climate change now. I mean, you know, how quickly did that come? You know, where suddenly vast majority of people think we have to do something about that. I think that's probably going to come with childcare, where there's a realization that as a nation. And that comes down with the U.S. and the different states, you know, are going to have to invest more. And that's going to come in, I suspect, subsidies to families more, more subsidies for the childcare workers to try to break that cycle we have right now.
Perry, thanks for your story. How is the duck doing back there? Is the duck okay? Just chilling. Thank you for sharing your comments. Let's take another question here.
My name is Meredith. I'm here tonight because my husband is an engineer for Ford, and he was staying home with our daughter, and we couldn't speak highly enough about the new parent policy of 8 weeks full time off, and then a new parent ramp up of part time work for full time pay, and just the bond that he's able to have, and the confidence, and how comfortable he feels because he was able to stay home, and it was just like. Our friends were just blown away by, you know, this new and unheard of policy. And it's like, okay, if Ford's doing it, we can only hope that it'll start to trickle out and become a part of the culture. And trying to frame a question, it's like, we all know the issues of cost and quality. So are there ideas of, and to kind of go off of what you were saying, of there's this move for climate change, well, how can we help bring this to the forefront and help make it become an issue? We're all here tonight because, you know, this issue is passionate to us. I was here for the grammar one, you know, but how do we start to bring, how can we bring it to the forefront so that we can start to see the change that we all know, but it's not being recognized by the politicians?
Believe it or not, legislators do pay attention to the phone calls they get. They don't get all that many. And so if you talk to your district representative and your state senator from your area, place a call to them, write a note to them on that issue. You reach a critical mass and they start paying attention. They count on your vote, you know. So it sounds, maybe that's too simple, but as far as what an individual can do in our situation and anyone in this room, that can make a difference. I've seen it happen.
Is there something particular that you'd like to see changed in that? I mean, I know we're talked a lot about funding and funding gets to the core of it, but is there a particular policy or something that is of interest to you?
Well, just a second, what Ron had said earlier, I would like to see that there be an increase to the eligibility. The right now it's 130% of federal poverty level. I would like to see an increase in that, and also an increase in the rates that providers are reimbursed. So right, it's a very complicated system of how providers get reimbursed when they do accept subsidy based on, you know, if they participate in Great Start to Quality and what age the children are and, you know, lots of different complicated factors. But overall, the rates are pretty low for of reimbursement, as Ron was talking about earlier. So if we both increase the number of families that can be eligible for that child care subsidy and also increase the provider reimbursements, that would have a huge impact on the system as a whole.
All right, let's take another.
Hi, my name is Joe Gacho, and this is Maya, our first.
Hi, Maya.
Enjoying her issue in ale. She has a lot of issues, though. So I work for the city government of Ferndale, Michigan, actually, and we were the first municipality to adopt a three-month paternity policy. And actually, to speak to that, what can we do? I would say our local population, our local elected officials, found that as a priority. One, out of our core values for our city, but two, because we found it a competitive advantage for talent and local government management. So I work in the city manager's office, and we found it to be competitive for both our police department, fire department, and it's just citywide staff in general. You need to recruit. It's competitive in our field. So I'd say for your local municipality, race is an issue for you as your local population, your local elected officials, and everything trickles upward in politics.
All right. Thank you for your comment.
We say hi.
Oh.
Say bye-bye. Bye-bye. No.
Dead air.
Hi, I am a mom of two. I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old, but I also am a owner of a child care center. So I'm very familiar with all of you guys. We're also a Reggio-inspired center. It's very passionate to me that I bought the center in 16 and 2016, not when I was 16. I was working in child care at 17. That's before they had the law. But yeah, I've been in the field for many, many years. And, you know, one of the things that's really important to us is that we give kids what they need. And part of the STARS program, which I think it's a great start to what we need, but I have some qualms. You know, like, we need to educate parents what the STARS mean. Just because you're a 3-star program does not mean you're a top, like, you are pretty high up there if you meet at least the 3 stars. Mm-hmm. Every star is meaning you're making, expectations are much higher than just licensing.
Could I ask you to explain a little bit more about the STAR program for those who aren't familiar with it?
So the STARS is the Great Start to Quality, and you earn STARS based off of what you're doing to meeting the qualifications. So maybe one of the qualifications are you have lower ratio to teacher child-to-teacher ratios than what the licensing is asked for, or you have a curriculum based off of their choices. That was one of the ones I had a problem with. You know, Reggio luckily fit with our options, but they don't have an assessment option that matches Reggio. At least in this area, it's all about high scope, which has, again, a lot of great parts to it, but it's not what we like. So we've already decided we're not going to be a 5-star program because we're going to say no to that part of the STARS. So, you know, when families come in, I say we're not an academically focused center. We're a large center. We took over a Bright Horizons building. It's huge. But it's important to know, to educate the parents about what STARS mean. Mm-hmm. Like, if you want them to actually base it and you go, okay, well, it's only a 3-star program, and you think of restaurants that are getting 3 stars out of 5, it's not the same thing. A 3-star program, they're already meeting some pretty high expectations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other problem is with, like, just like child cares are having a hard time staffing, child care networks having a hard time staffing. We have gone through multiple consultants, so we're on now a wait list to be able to renew our STARS, and we can't even talk to anyone right now. And I'm not blaming you guys. You guys are amazing. You guys are going through the same problems we are going through. We're all fighting over the same staff. I just got out of a director's meeting today for the Washington County, and we're all just like, okay, who wants to share subs? You know, sometimes I have extra staff. Let's make this work. Like, we're in a group of people that we are not competing with each other at this point. If you're a quality center, you want everyone to grow and do better because you care about those kids. But at the same time, we need to educate parents on what is quality. So you can't just say 3 stars, 1 star, 5 stars. You got to say, here are what we're looking for. What is quality? So parents can understand.
Thank you for your comment, Annette.
I just want to tag onto that. The state does define high quality as anything 3 stars or higher. So yes. And I think, I think it is important for parents to understand that. Right now we have at the state of Michigan, for all licensed child care providers in the state of Michigan, we have 50% of providers who participate in grades, 50.74 or something like that. I don't forget what the latest number is, but, so 50.74 of providers who participate in Great Start to Quality, which is, as she talked about the STARS program, the tiered quality rating and improvement system. And so, yes, it is really important for parents to understand what that means and what each of the STARS level mean, and that it's not like a hotel. It's not the same thing. That every STAR means that a provider is going above and beyond what is required by licensing and trying to provide additional measures of quality to the kids in their care. That's critical that we help parents understand that.
All right. Let's. Did we have a question over here? Oh, okay. That'd be great.
And I work with Jennifer. Jennifer and I are colleagues. And I just wanted people to know that, you know, 92% of our tuition from families goes to wages and benefits. So that's a pretty high percentage. So when you said that money's to be made, it's not necessarily true. And then the cost to families. We have families from all over the country, all over the world, and at one point we had 32 spoken languages by families in our center, and they're choosing to put their child care costs on credit or as a student loan. So even though, I mean, we come from an area of privilege, and I understand that, but I want to give you the fuller continuum of the families that we serve.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask each of you to just kind of give us maybe a closing thought about something that you're optimistic about. Maybe we could end on a positive note if that is possible. Jennifer, could I start with you? What are you excited about when you go to work, or what are you excited about that you see in the field?
Like I've been saying all along, the children, just being children, allowing them to be children.
Annette?
So I'm excited that that you're hosting this tonight on this topic. I'm excited that there's more attention now on childcare than ever since, you know, than a long time. Just the fact that all of these people are here today to talk more about this topic, I think that speaks to where we're going, the direction that we're going, and it's only up.
Yes, thank you all for coming. You should give yourselves a round of applause. And Ron, what are you optimistic about? You don't get off the hook here.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Ron's clapping us out here.
No, I just want to piggyback on what you said here. It's you know, I think having meetings like this, there is a momentum out there. It's tough to see it now because everyone's still suffering. Everyone's still paying this crazy amount of money and making so little money. But the fact that it is on people's minds in Lansing, it's just going to take some time. And this is how it gets started, how change gets started.
I'd like you to thank our panelists, Ron French and Anna Sobosinski and Jennifer Crutchfield, Annette Sobosinski and Jennifer Crutchfield. Let's give them a round of applause. And thank you all for coming out tonight and being part of this and for all the thoughtful comments and questions. It's really very much appreciated. Thank you very much.